Marston at the Park Plaza Hotel. This is the headquarters for the COGSI 2011 meeting. And we're talking to Stephen Sloman from Brown. Let me get right into this and play back to you something from your webpage.
Sure.
I study how people think in the face of uncertainty. My goal is to understand the flexibility of cognition, how people are able to think effectively in entirely new situations with little prior knowledge. That sounds staggering. I mean...
Well, people are staggering.
How do you do that?
You try to understand what the process is by which people think. And what's amazing about people, I believe, is their ability to adapt to novel situations, their ability to integrate new information, their ability to understand things that are completely outside their experience. And so the way you study it is by generating hypotheses, and in cognitive science, those hypotheses are often in the form of computational models, right. And then you test the models.
Now, when you say things that are completely outside people's experience, are you talking about completely outside, or are you talking about a little bit different from?
That's a really good question. I think that the way we operate, I mean, that's a very hard question to answer because there's no objective measure of difference, right? So if I throw you in a completely new environment and you succeed, how different is it really to what you've encountered in the past? And what you're insinuating, I think, is exactly right, that what we do is to import the habits, the skills, the knowledge that we've gained from other occasions, from other situations in our life, and import them into whatever situation we happen to be. But look, compare our situation to that of a dog, right? So you take a dog and you put him or her in an airplane. That dog is not going to adapt to that airplane very well, right? Whereas you can take a human being and give them a little bit of knowledge, like this thing flies and you don't want to be thrown around in it, and they're going to adapt pretty quickly to an airplane or to a spaceship, and according to the movies, to, you know, space stations on Mars. And I don't think that's unrealistic. We're able to model our environment and understand it in a way that we can import the right pieces of knowledge and the right actions into situations that we haven't encountered before.
Okay, so it says here also, my working hypothesis, just to play this back at you,
okay,
is that people do this by combining general logic-like rules with sophisticated memories, which is what we just kind of talked about.
Yeah. All right. So
you do categorization, judgments of probability, and so on, and that's what we do, isn't it, on a daily basis?
I think so, not explicitly, but we're constantly taking actions that are sensitive to the likelihood of different outcomes and different events.
Right.
Right. So when we cross the street, we do it in such a way that we minimize the probability we're going to be hit by a car, even though we know it is a possibility.
Except, of course, the society is set up in such a way that there are buttons that you push that tell you how many seconds you have to walk across the street.
Oh, really? People follow those rules in your part of the world?
Okay, so we're in Boston. So.
Yes, well, right, we're in Boston. Those are almost irrelevant. No, that's true. Society helps us, right, to the extent that it can. It provides certain kinds of rules.
Yeah.
But I do think that those rules are not identical with the rules that govern behavior, right? So there are certain societies that try to adjust the rules to make them as consistent as possible with the way people behave. I think Americans try to do that. They like their rules to actually be both normative, right, to describe what they think they should be doing, as well as descriptive, that is to describe what they are in fact doing. You know, my sense is that in Europe, people are less concerned about that. They're more willing to have a set of rules that are sort of the official description of what we expect of people that are quite independent of what people actually do. So rules exist at many different levels and in many different ways.
So let's go back to this notion of the people in the face of uncertainty. How could you possibly model? I mean, how technically do you go about modeling that sort of thing?
Well,
because I mean, how do you model?
So here's my best guess. I mean, that's a great question, and every cognitive scientist is going to give you a different answer to that question. And in a sense, that's the million-dollar question of cognitive science. The winner of the major cognitive science prize this year, the Rummelhart Prize, was Judea Pearl. And I was heavily influenced by his answer to that question. And in fact, my current research is an attempt to take his answer and test to see whether it describes human behavior, whether it describes how human cognition solves exactly the problem that
Would you mind setting that up for me?
So the idea is that the way we understand a world that's full of uncertainty is by trying to understand the mechanisms that make the world go round. Right? So Pearl's book that he published in 2000 is called Causal Models, or at least it's about causal models. Right. And a causal model is a description of all the variables, all the events and categories and types of things that exist in the world. And it's an attempt to describe how some of them lead to other things, right? So how is it that the sun going around the earth and the fact that there are cars and factories leads to increases in temperature around the world? It leads to global warming, right? We have causal beliefs about those mechanisms. We have causal beliefs about how cars themselves work. We have causal beliefs about how my behavior will affect your behavior.
Right.
And so the idea, Pearl's idea, is that if you put all these beliefs together in a coherent way, in a structured format, you can explain how the world works and how the world could work. In other words, you can explain not only what happens, but what else could have happened. And in a sense, that's capturing uncertainty, right? Because that's what uncertainty represents. Uncertainty reflects the difference between what does happen or what will happen and what the other set of possible outcomes are. So the idea is that by understanding the causal mechanisms which drive the world, we know what the most likely outcome is. And we know what the other possible outcomes are. And moreover, we know how important each of those outcomes are. So the way we deal with uncertainty is by A, taking a good guess, by understanding what produces the things we care about, and also by understanding what it is that we care about and what it is other people care about.
The trouble is being blindsided. I mean, I don't use this example lightly, of course, but I mean, Judeo is the father of Daniel Pearl. How could he have known about that? There's no way of predicting for that. That's a uncertainty in spades.
That's true. So, look, sometimes our means of protecting ourselves, our means of dealing with what the world can lead to, sometimes those means fail. You know, there are things that happen to us that we simply have no way of predicting and no way of dealing with, unfortunately. But there are beliefs, there are systems, individual systems, cultural systems, right, communities that are designed to deal with that kind of unexpected event as well as we possibly can.
But that's an important point, isn't it?
Sure,
there's
I think so.
A community is involved in providing a support system.
Absolutely. Actually, can I just elaborate on that?
But also make it relevant. Your book on causal models as well. Yes. I mean, that's all part of this discussion, really. I mean,
right. So a really interesting question, I think, is do causal models exist in individual minds, or rather, are they entities that belong to a community of knowledge? And so not only are there social systems and communities that are there in order to deal with the repercussions of events, but I actually think that our predictions and our ways of dealing with the world are a function of our community, right? They go beyond our individual minds in the sense that I do believe that our knowledge, our causal knowledge, does exist within a community and not merely in individuals. For instance, you know, I know that there are people out there who can fix my car because I sure as hell can't. And so I have enough causal knowledge to allow me to know when I should go to the mechanic and when I shouldn't. You know, when I should go to the junkyard. There are certain things that happen to my car that all I know is that it shouldn't be so because the car's not starting and this guy down the block is able to fix it because he has the requisite causal knowledge. Right. So our knowledge about the world, knowledge that we actually use on a day-to-day basis, I believe, in fact, is distributed throughout the community, and we're making use of other people all the time when we make decisions and when we make predictions.
So how did you actually get into this entire sphere of activity? I mean, were you always planning to be a scientist of some kind, or a book, a teacher, parents? What?
Yeah, you know, I wish I had a more interesting answer to that question, but I think I just fell into it. It kind of came as a natural. When I was a teenager, I would read books about the mind. I was always interested in computation, and I was always interested in what kind of computations could describe, you know, the incredible phenomena that the mind is capable of generating.
Do you remember the books you were reading?
Well, one was Gödel, Escher, Bach by Douglas Hofstetter.
Doug's, yeah.
Yeah. You know, as a young teenager, I read a lot of Hermann Hesse, and I think some of these questions are implicit in what he had to say.
Hinduistic version of
well, that's right.
Things.
Look, there are branches of Buddhism that really do cognitive science.
Right.
Right. I mean, meditation is, or certain types of meditation, is one entree into the study of mind.
When you get to where did you first go to college?
University of Toronto.
Toronto.
I'm Canadian.
And you're reading, at that point you're reading for BSc, I assume,
in
Canada.
That's right. I studied memory as an undergraduate. I worked with a gentleman named Endel Tulving, who's well known in the study of memory.
Well, you were very lucky.
Yes, I was very lucky.
I mean, Tulving is one of the great figures of memory.
That's right. He's quite a brilliant man, and as has been described as a maverick.
Yeah.
And I don't think I've succeeded, but I've always taken that as a model to pursue in my scientific career.
This wasn't at McGill, was it? Then?
University of Toronto. No, he was at Toronto.
So Brenda Milner was at McGill,
and
Donald Hebb was at McGill. So there's this interesting little constellation of Canadian folks interested in memory and cortex.
That's true.
All right, so memories of Tulving?
Well, Tulving was a man who you called professor until you had a PhD, and then you were allowed to call him Endel. So he was a very rule-governed man.
Yeah.
You know, Endel, I have a PhD, so I can now call him Endel. he gave me a fair amount of freedom as an undergraduate. He was very well known and very busy, and so he allowed me to pursue a number of interests on my own, and then would sort of take the final project and the final product and transform it into something that hopefully was meaningful and digestible by the larger community.
Did he give you advice? I mean, I'm going to follow this up with a question, which is that Peter Medawar wrote a book called Advice to a Young Scientist. Do you have any sense of kids who are out there listening to you right now about what you would tell them to do based on what they told you to do or what they told you not to do and so on and so forth?
Huh.
What works?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. One of the criteria that Tolving would always impose on a student when a student had thought they had something to say was, do you have something that hasn't been said before and is worth saying? Yeah. So the idea was that not all ideas are worth sharing.
Right.
And I actually feel that in science today that that's very useful advice. You know, there's a lot of stuff out there, and the hardest thing as a scientist is to filter out the chaff in order to find the wheat. And I feel like as scientists, it's our responsibility to help the larger community do that by only providing wheat. Not that I've always succeeded in doing that, but I think it would be very helpful if everybody took that as an objective.
No chaff providers.
No chaff providers. That's a good name for my lab. Maybe I'll put that on my license plate. No chaff providers here.
Tell me about, one of the speakers here is going to be, and we've spoken about this last night, so we can extend that conversation. One of the speakers here is Noam Chomsky.
Yeah.
Impact on you?
You can't avoid the effects of Chomsky on the field because he was one of the founders of the field, and he provided one of the frameworks that has dominated the field. I think at this point I would say his impact on me is as something to react to.
Right.
That is,
right.
I see him as the founder of what I call high church cognition, the notion that, right? So we call it compositional structure in the field, but the idea that you can take thoughts and break them into primitives, and the goal of cognitive science is to understand what those primitives are and how to put them together in ways that produce, you know, all the richness of thought and language, obviously, in Chomsky's case.
Right.
I'm not convinced that's the most productive way to study the human mind. It leads you to take a particular approach. It leads to a certain kind of modeling that you don't see that much anymore. That has largely proved unsuccessful. Now, please appreciate that I'm talking about old Chomsky, right? Chomsky's gone through a number of phases, and I'm he himself has perhaps rejected the position that I'm now discussing. But I think there are many facts about the mind that are simply not amenable to that kind of analysis. So one we've already talked about, the fact that knowledge is something that belongs to a community and not an individual, right?
Yeah.
Another is that knowledge is closely tied to action. So there's all kinds of reason to believe that when we have a thought about an object, that what is part and parcel of that thought is sensations that are relevant to that object, perceptions that are relevant to that object, actions that are relevant to that object. So not only is knowledge part and parcel of a community, it's actually part and parcel of an entire body and the system of artifacts that that body interacts with, right? So, you know, one of my favorite examples is it's very different to think about playing guitar, or maybe I should, it's not that different to think about playing guitar and to actually be playing a guitar, right? in the sense that the notion of playing guitar is tied up with the actual instrument that's in your hand when you're playing it. It's hard to even articulate what it means to play guitar, right? Even though we have lots and lots of thoughts about it, because there are a set of actions that really constitute, in a way, those thoughts.
Well, except that, you know, I mean, if you want to play air guitar, you can do that, and it looks like you're doing something, and
you do it very well.
You think you're doing something, but to actually produce notes on this instrument, that's a whole course of learning. I mean, huge investment of learning in figuring out whether you can actually do that.
Right. So my point is that you're not going to be able to learn to play guitar without a guitar.
Right.
Right. So the guitar is part and parcel of this process of learning.
Right.
And in that sense, this learning process that presumably has something to do that's taking place inside the skull extends beyond that, right? And it extends through the arms to the fingers. And I would argue, along with a number of other people, that the guitar is actually relevant to that. It's part of the system that's doing the learning. You change the guitar, then everything else has to adjust a little bit too. And often other people are part of this process as well.
Right? So, you know, as we sit here at CogSci 2011, and we're talking about the Cognitive Science Conference, I assume that most of the people here have got some sort of a model of how the mind works. Yeah. I asked this last year. It's kind of a mean question, but
yeah, that's all right.
But because they don't.
No, they don't. I think they have presuppositions about how the mind works.
What's your version of how the mind works?
I think that there are two layers of mind. One of them you can think of as intuition, as a cognitive process that generates answers, that makes inferences in a way that you can't introspect about. So you're not conscious of the process by which inferences are made, by which thought takes place, but you're aware of the results of the process, right?
Right.
So if I ask you, you know, what Napoleon's last name was, presumably you can generate that answer, but you don't know how that happened. And if I ask you what 13 plus 6 is, I suspect you can answer that pretty quickly too, without doing a lot of calculation. So on one hand, there's that kind of cognitive process that goes on. But on the other hand, there's a highly reflective process, right? That, you know, I have called a rule-based process that these days I'd like to refer to as deliberation. That's a very different kind of cognitive process that involves analyzing things, picking out key important elements, and reasoning about them explicitly. So if I ask you what 362 plus 104 is, you can answer that question too, but it's a very different process than 13 plus 6. Because you don't know the answer right away. Rather, you have to calculate the answer.
Right. But let's take the other point you made when you said, let's just explore that one, where you said, the name Napoleon, all right. Now, you expected me to think of Bonaparte.
Yes, I did.
I also know Napoleon Chagnon, who's a great evolutionary biologist. So. When we get to the second part of what you're discussing there, is that when I'm doing
the deliberation?
Am I thinking about Nap Chagnon, or am I thinking about Bonaparte, who I didn't even know, but I know the other guy?
Right. Well, what makes it, I mean, it's a great question. What makes this hard to study is the fact that we have access to both of these systems, and both of these systems tend to be producing responses.
Yeah.
Right? A business professor at MIT, I think he's still at MIT, named Shane Fredericks, who designed a beautiful test that demonstrates that both of these systems are in some sense operating at the same time.
Right.
So I'll give you an example of one of his test questions. he asks, there's someone went and bought a bat and a ball, and the bat and the ball together cost $1.10. They paid $1 more for the bat than for the ball. How much did the ball cost?
Obvious answer is 10 cents, right? Right. That's what most people would say, right?
That's what most people would say. But that answer doesn't actually work if you do the calculations, right? Because if it's the ball was 10 cents and the bat is then a dollar more, the bat is $1.10. And the sum of those two is $1.20. So 10 cents comes to everybody's mind. You're absolutely right. It comes to everybody's mind associatively, right? Intuitively. Some people aren't satisfied by that. They deliberate a little more and say, ooh, that doesn't work. And they come to a better answer. I'll let you figure out what the better answer is. That better answer requires some deliberation. So people seem to differ in the degree to which they deliberate versus intuit.
Right.
And these individual differences actually are predictive of a number of things. It's quite amazing what they're predictive of. But I think that what that kind of example shows is that we do have access to both of these processes, and to answer any particular question, both are operating at the same time. And so there's this constant interaction between them. One feeds the other, the second feeds the first. And so I think that's your example of Napoleon was exactly of that type. So Bonaparte came to mind, but then while you were answering intuitively, another part of your mind was deliberating about it and saying, well, what other Napoleons do I know? And what is this guy really asking me anyway?
Right. So take the example you just used. I mean, those are socially relevant examples. You know, and they're in advertising, for heaven's sake. Uh-huh. So the relevance of science, mm-hmm, in society, the importance of people knowing more science.
Mm.
The president comes into brings in a new administration, says we will restore science to its rightful place. What is the rightful place of science?
Well, it's another interesting question, and I guess I have two feelings about that. I mean, on one hand, I agree with what I take to be conventional wisdom, that the more educated we are, the better our decisions will be. And this is precisely because we do have an intuitive sense, and these intuitions sometimes lead us astray. They sometimes lead us to the conclusion that a ball costs 10 cents when in fact it only costs 5. And so the more education we have, the more likely we are to have the tools available to suppress those intuitions and to deliberate and come to better, more rational answers. And I do believe that's true. I mean, I think it's absolutely critical for a society to have a set of people who are capable of deliberating and deliberating in effective ways. And presumably that's in part what a science education does. And then presumably scientists are able to do that kind of deliberation within their sphere of knowledge. On the other hand, I also think that we
get phone calls all the time. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I don't. So, on the other hand, I think that sometimes we hold academic pursuits to a higher level of esteem than they deserve, and it's not clear to me that everybody in America needs to go to college, for instance. I think there are other perfectly reasonable and effective ways to pursue life than to get a college education. There are other ways to learn than through college. So, I mean, perhaps I'm answering two different questions.
Well, no, that's interesting, because that's your intuitive stuff coming out there, isn't it? I mean, it's
well, I have thought about it a little bit. I mean, why should the guy who does the wiring in my house, why does he have to study Chaucer, right? I mean, wouldn't he be better off apprenticing, you know, going to a trade school and learning what's required for his trade to give him more time to learn the guitar?
The guy in your house doing the wiring might well be actually studying, Chaucer. That's my point.
No, well, sure. Oh, and if that's what he wants to do, great. I have no problem. I don't see that there's a need for society to prescribe that. Right? Like, why should he be studying Chaucer? Why is studying Chaucer better than learning to play the guitar or traveling around the world or, you know, one of many other pursuits?
So you're saying that although people are required to get, are required in this society to have an official education with an official stamp at the end of their thing, such as BSc or PhD or whatever, that you would far rather that there was a society in which they were encouraged to learn widely, independently of these affirmations.
So I was talking about academic programs. I think America, in particular, holds in very high esteem the notion of getting a college degree,
right?
Which is a particular kind of degree. So I'm contrasting that to a trade school certificate,
right?
Or any other kind of education.
Right.
It's not obvious to me that all college students spend a significant proportion of their time improving themselves in the best way that they possibly could. Right? And I see no reason to show any disrespect for someone who wants to learn a trade,
right?
And not through college, but some other way. Either through some kind of technical school or via an apprenticeship.
Right.
I mean, I think there are lots of ways to get an education, and we tend to overvalue college as one of them.
Okay. Did you ever consider doing anything else? I mean, are you a frustrated opera singer or something? Or
Yeah, I'm a frustrated rock star.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, sure, there are lots of other things that I'd like to be if you gave me the option of being president of the United States right now. I don't think I would turn it down, perhaps the detriment of the country.
Do you play an instrument?
I play guitar very badly. Art Markman just walked in, who plays saxophone very well, so he tells me.
Yeah. And is the editor of the Journal of Cognitive Science, right?
That's right. I don't know if the two are related. You'll have to ask Art about that.
Last couple of questions, okay. One's a cultural thing about history and philosophy of science and culture. If I gave you a time travel token and said you could bring anybody to your dinner table, who do you want to talk to? Who do you want to ask questions of?
Maybe William James.
Yeah.
He's an interesting guy.
I had a feeling you were going to say that, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, then the interesting question is how you knew. What have I said to divulge such a secret of my character?
Jamesian stuff is just is so inherent in this whole cogsci thing.
That, yeah, no,
and
look.
Boston.
True enough. I think that to some degree, cognitive science is an effort to say something that James didn't. And, you know, some people have succeeded, but not as many as think they have.
Yeah. Final thing, what are you optimistic about?
What am I optimistic about? I'm optimistic about my kids' future. I think that the world is that the political world is on average changing for the better. I think that they're going to have more options that are more consistent with their desires and their skills and their talents than previous generations have. And I think part and parcel of that is the fact that our society has encouraged encouraged research, has encouraged asking the kinds of questions that all scientists ask, including cognitive scientists. So, you know, I feel like our society is heading in a direction that corresponds more to reality than it has in the past.
Okay, On the Path to Reality with Steve Sloman. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to talk to you.